I'm speaking today with Joe Jaworski, candidate for state senate in District 11. Joe, I usually start off asking people about why they're running, but I think we need to get to some more basic stuff first. You know, your house is in Galveston, which kind of got wiped out by Hurricane Ike. Tell me, I mean, you've been to the island and been doing a lot of recovery-related work out there. Tell me what it looks like and what's going on down there.
Well, Charles, you bet. Good morning. Ike, you know, came on to Galveston Island, you know, September 13th, and I was down there literally the next morning. And what I saw was, you know, beyond my wildest imagination. You know, we always know that this is something that you have to face every summer. But, you know, long story short, this was the 1900 storm with a seawall. And so the flooding occurred principally from the harbor and from Offutt's Bayou, both of which are fed by Galveston Bay. You know, the Gulf of Mexico was strong and beat that seawall hard, but most of the homes that are a couple of rows behind the seawall, that's the highest point of the island, and they did not suffer flood damage. But the main urban core that is the Strand, the East End Historic District, all those homes along Broadway in the 50s and 40s suffered anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 feet of water inside their house. So anyone who was touched by water lost their first floor. What you also saw is probably about 110 mile an hour wind gusts, and a lot of kind of poorly maintained homes have literally just imploded. But a lot of the homes that were built since Alicia with the new windstorm codes survived the wind very well. The far west end, which unfortunately is a large part of the tax base in Galveston, while some of the newer structures still stand, they're trashed inside. And, you know, what I want you to know is that the entire island was underwater during the height of the storm. You would not have seen a piece of land had you hypothetically flown over it. So, you know, that's a pretty serious thing. What then happened, of course, was a look and leave policy that was difficult to implement, and so there was about 10 to 12 days where people couldn't get to their homes. And so even though the water's gone, what you see now is everything's brown because all the vegetation was under salt water, and people's homes are full of mildew and mold. As you drive the streets now, electricity is on in about half the city, and it'll be 100% probably in about 2 weeks. For the electricity. The natural gas is on, the water's coming back on, but what you see is debris everywhere, and people are having to tear out the sheetrock in their homes. Businesses are, you know, looking to see who their customers are right now and who's staying. So I spoke to a few people, Charles, that actually stayed through the storm, and I heard harrowing stories of literally walking in turgid water up to your Adam's apple. And that's an image that scares me. But some of these people have this look of the ravaged survivor, and they're full of adrenaline. As you walk through the streets right now, there's still a curfew. There's no light in the neighborhoods, but there's Salvation Army trucks handing out really good food. There's Mormon congregants walking through the neighborhoods, helping people with their appliances. There's actually a lot to be hopeful about, which is the message that I want to leave at the end of this first question. There's a lot to be hopeful about. Galveston has always rebuilt, and it will rebuild now. And I will tell you this, Charles, even though I've lost the downstairs to my home and it's going to take 9 months to fix it, I have never felt more urgent about my mission to represent Galveston County, and more particularly Galveston Island in the Texas Senate. Now more than ever, they need someone from Galveston.
Well, when you get to the Senate, you know, what's the top priority from a state legislative perspective to help mitigate against this sort of thing? You can't prevent it, obviously. What can you do to mitigate against it in the future?
And I'll answer that. Probably the first priority, now that Hurricane Ike has done such great devastation to Galveston. The good news is there was not a massive loss of life. I mean, there were some people who died, and my heart goes out to those families. And anytime loss of life happens, you have to respect that that's a profound loss. But we're not talking about, you know, 1,000 people dead like Katrina. But the property damage is severe, which is why our mayor and the port chairman, or you know, the chairman of the Galveston Wharves, and the president of University of Texas Medical Branch, the biggest employer on the island, sort of the big three, if you will, all went to Congress, to the Senate Subcommittee on Disaster Relief, and asked for $2.3 billion. Whatever number Congress ultimately appropriates to Galveston Island for this, you know, great devastation, it goes through the state of Texas, Charles. It doesn't go straight to the Galveston General Fund. It has to go, as federal appropriations often do, whether you're talking about Medicaid or, you know, other federal programs. This goes to the state of Texas. That's what happened when Rita ravaged East Texas. Did you know that 3 years later, 90% of that money still sits in Austin? And we can't let that happen in Galveston. So to answer your question, the most urgent matter for Galveston post-Ike is to elect a senator who will work tirelessly and relentlessly to make sure that that federal money, whatever the sum that is appropriated for this, actually gets into the hands of Galveston Island, where it can do the most good. As far as mitigating, you know, where we're talking about next season and the season that follows, we need to make sure that contractors are licensed. We need to make sure that there is some relief for Galveston's property tax situation, because, you know, I don't know what the appraisals are going to be like on destroyed homes. You know, you would think people who are homeowners would have a pretty good argument that, hey, why should I pay tax when I can't even live in my house? That's going to be an issue. What's that going to do to the Galveston tax base? How are we going to pay for basic services? And then, of course, there's the question of windstorm insurance and flood insurance, and are they being responsive? I'm already hearing lots of rumors and a lot of stories about insurance adjusters that are basically denying claims, windstorm pointing the finger at flood, and vice versa. This is exactly what happened in Mississippi and Louisiana after Katrina. And, you know, you're talking about people that have lost a lot, and now they're having to deal with very seasoned adjusters who know how to speak their language. You know, we pay our premiums. We think everything's going to be okay when we need it. Come to find out, you need to be a lawyer or more to understand what it is they're saying to you.
Now, anytime there is a storm like this, and we saw this with Katrina, we see this occasionally with hurricanes on the East Coast and with floods along rivers, there are people who will say, well, you know, why should I have to pay to bail out Galveston? Why should we pay $2 billion to rebuild someplace that's going to get hit by a hurricane and flood again? So how do you deal with that when people say we shouldn't rebuild Galveston?
Well, you know, it is. It's the politics of disaster are intriguing. And here's what I have to say about that. I mean, you know, history, when people came to America from Europe or wherever they came from, you know, they often settled in coastal communities. You know, that was just because once they got there, they didn't feel like traveling anymore. Well, Galveston is such a place. I mean, it became an entity in the 1830s. You know, it's obvious that Galveston has been around for nearly 200 years. You can't discount that, the fact that there is such a history there, that generations of people have prospered and lived there. The fact that a seawall was built right after the 1900 storm with great federal assistance, you know, by Colonel Roberts, in fact. He was the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer leader who was the engineer of the seawall, the same Roberts who wrote Robert's Rules of Order, you know, tells me that 100 years ago, there was no question that Galveston was worth, and most coastal communities were worth saving. 100 years later, there is this question now. And here's what I want to say to Texans right now who may not feel like it's their problem. You cannot divorce yourself from the fact that Galveston County and Galveston Island and the Port of Houston and this whole coastal Galveston Bay region is a leader in the state's economy. Whether it's the Port of Galveston, the Port of Texas City, the Port of Houston, or the refining areas in Pasadena, La Porte, Deer Park, Baytown, that complex plays a leading role in the state's economy. You have to have people who run and, you know, service and cater to these industries who live nearby. You can't helicopter people in from Amarillo every day to service the Port of Houston or to work at the refinery in Texas City. So there needs to be a bustling residential and a diverse business economy on the coast so that these key elements of the Texas economy keep robust. To suggest somehow that people shouldn't live in Galveston or Texas City or even places that flooded worse than the Island Charles, like Kima or Clear Lake or LaPorte, is ignoring the fact that this whole Bay Area, whether it's from an environmental perspective or an oil and gas perspective or a tourism perspective, plays a significant role in the state's well-being.
Okay. You know, obviously, you know, your campaign, you know, was affected by the hurricane as well. Talk to me a little bit about how your campaign has responded to this, and also about the fact that there's probably going to be a lot of people who were registered to vote in Galveston, but who are not going to be in Galveston to vote. How are you dealing with that?
Well, first off, you know, kudos to my incredible campaign staff. You know, Brooke Heller, my field director, Angie Patterson, my campaign manager, Kareem Plummer, the finance director, you know, Alex Rodenberry, the deputy field, you know, these folks obviously had their own losses. You know, I mean, Brooke was living with former Judge Norma Venzo on the West End, home wiped out. Angie Patterson was living in the East End, whole downstairs apartment wiped out. Kareem Plummer lives up in Clear Lake Shores, home wiped out. I mean, again, this is the message I want to give you, is that it wasn't just Galveston Island, it's other parts of Senate District 11 that fared just as poorly. Nevertheless, these folks, with their loss, understood that I was going to stay on the island and I was going to be incommunicado for about 2 weeks. What I did, what the candidate did, is I would drive back and forth from Houston to Galveston every morning at 5 in the morning, and I was helping, you know, the Galveston Island debris removal get started. And in the course of doing that, since I was on the island, I would get text messages, cell phone, emails, and thank goodness my BlackBerry worked, so I'm ready to do the commercial for BlackBerry now. And people would frantically text me, you know, we thought we'd be coming back right away. Now we understand we can't come back indefinitely. My cat is in my house. I basically have now written the feline exception to the breaking and entering law. And so I was asked to break into people's homes, you know, and rip the plywood off and go rescue these cats. I did that on several occasions. The campaign staff stayed focused on relevant, tangible information that they could get out. And it's kind of funny, you do things by email. A lot of people didn't have electricity, but as the electricity in the county started coming back online, we found that people were using this information and getting the information out. And so I'm very proud of my staff, very proud. We suspended the campaign, Charles, for, you know, an indefinite period of time. And after, you know, about 10, maybe 12 days of getting down in the dirt here in Galveston, you know, I had enough people tell me, okay, man, it's time to win your election. Let's go. And so we're back. It's less than 30 days to early voting. To answer the second part of your question, the Senate District 11 portion of Galveston Island is probably about 11,000 registered voters. Of those, you know, I'd say 7,000, somewhere between 4,000 and 7,000 are, you know, hardcore Democratic supporters. Now, you know, the fact is, since I'm the local guy, I'm going to get the Republican support as well. So we want to make sure that every single one of those registered voters has a chance to vote. The good news, there will be voting on Galveston Island. I mean, there's electricity, the streets are open, superstore, you know, supermarkets are open. Some of the smaller businesses are probably going to find that there's no customers, and that it's going to take a little while for that to get back online. But the people are alive, they're at home, a lot of them are wondering just what they're going to do. We're going to make sure, Charles, that on every day of early voting and on election day, that we are getting to them. We've already sent a direct mail piece out to everyone on Galveston Island, and I know you're saying, well, wait a minute, how's that going to get to them? A direct mail piece with an application to vote by mail. If, in fact, they are out of the county, They'll be able to vote by mail. We're giving the application to them so that they can make that happen. Number two, there's apparently a meeting today. The Secretary of State is meeting in Galveston with the County Commissioner's Court and the Tax Assessor Collector to work out the details for a super precinct type event on Election Day. As you know, the law already allows people on every day of early voting to vote anywhere in the county. We want to expand that onto November 4th. And that's reasonable, I think, because a lot of folks in Galveston, even though they can drive to their house every day if they want, it's not necessarily going to be livable for a while. And so they're living with their relatives or a friend in Lamarck, let's say, or Texas City, or maybe League City. It would be, I think, conducive to the voting experience to let those folks vote in the county, maybe not at their precinct in Galveston, but in the county, not just in early voting, but on Election Day. So that's what we're pushing for.
Okay. One of the things that has come out post-Ike is questions about the electrical infrastructure. Your future colleague, perhaps Senator Whitmire, has talked about doing some investigations and hearings on requiring CenterPoint to beef up its infrastructure. The Public Utility Commission had had a recommendation for that wasn't adopted. The electrical utilities have talked about it just being too expensive and having to pass that on to the customer. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where you wake up every morning and absent a disaster, you think of the electrical grid or, ERCOT. You just do check, the electricity works, I move on with my life. Now that all this stuff, is in a disaster mode, you find out just how good it is. Senator Whitmire is someone who knows his game. And, if I didn't know anything about the issue, I'd be inclined to trust him on his due diligence. What I do know is that the money that we've been paying has to have gone somewhere. And it would be nice to know that something as essential to life and business and commerce as electricity is, has at least some quality control that they're putting the money back into infrastructure. If they haven't been, well then shame on them, and there needs to be some regulation to make sure that every year X percentage of their money is going back into improving the infrastructure. That's what you'd expect a sound business practice to be. If that has not been happening, then I think hearings are appropriate.
Okay. One of the big things from the last legislative session, of course, was the adoption of the new business tax, which has had a lot of people unhappy since they're now having to pay it. Some complaints that it is too burdensome on smaller businesses and not enough on bigger businesses. What's your take on the business tax? What, if anything, would you like to see the legislature do with the business margins tax?
I think that it was hastily adopted, number one. I have heard more complaints from this than I do on the property tax, to be honest with you. And so what I would like is to start over and have a real, the Supreme Court order breathing down legislators' necks. I would like it to be something that is well thought out. So, I don't know that I necessarily would go in the way of retooling the business franchise tax. I'd like to have a more honest discussion as to what our options are in the state. I think small businesses now have the double whammy of sort of having the principal obligation to provide health care. They don't have to, but it's still sort of practically considered that business is how you get your health care these days. I think that's flawed. That's a flawed model. And now to sort of add on to this, the business margins tax, which really does, I think, put kind of a shock into small business to the exclusion of larger businesses that maybe are multi-state. Texas has had a penchant for over the last 20 years with the Republican leadership of saying, we're a great place to do business. Well, oftentimes we find it's the really large businesses that are doing well. I hear a lot of complaints from mom-and-pop businesses, and really even what you might consider large but still somewhat modest partnership and 40 employees and less type businesses. So, Charles, I don't know that I am necessarily on board with the business franchise tax, and all we got to do is tweak it a little bit. I'd like to go back to the drawing board and see what our full panoply of options are.
Okay. Obviously after the storm, there's going to be a lot of concerns about environmental issues. There's already been, certainly from the city of Houston's perspective, the city of Houston has been trying to go after some refineries and chemical plants that are outside its jurisdiction because of concerns about air pollution. There's now concerns about toxicity that has been leaked or spread around in the flooding. Texas doesn't really have a whole lot of strong enforcement of environmental laws. What do you want to see done going forward regarding environmental matters in Texas?
You know, this was an urgent issue with me even before the storm, but now with a very strong petrochemical smelling mud all throughout my neighborhood, all throughout Galveston, it takes on an even urgent tone, even more urgent tone. What I think the Texas legislature should do, and as you know, the next senator from Senate District 11, I would pursue, is to give the TCEQ a definitive indication that you are going to be given teeth and you are expected to use them. Here's the thing, you know, we've had leadership, my opponent at the forefront, that has benefited very nicely from the old saw that you got your Birkenstock long-haired environmentalists on the one side, and then you've got your responsible Chamber of Commerce businessmen on the other side. The fact is, we're all Texans, and we all live together, and all our kids go to school together, and we all shop at the supermarket together, and we all rise or fall together. And so real leadership does not let that sort of ad hominem imagination take root. Instead, I respect both groups. Absolutely I do. And what I would want to do is incentivize good conduct. Just like, you know, on healthcare, if people adopted wellness, then they would be less sick. And it's not all about the insurance companies or the doctors. You know, people can do things to make their life better. I want to incentivize that. I want to incentivize environmental practices by these very large and successful chemical and refining entities, and not let them get caught up in this sort of paranoid antagonistic relationship. Well, here they come again to try and, write laws to take away our profits. No. What we ought to do is be proud of the fact that Texas has been the breadbasket of refining and chemical industry over the last 100 years. But also, you know, as they say, with much success, you know, comes some responsibility to, you know, account for that success. I want to see Texas click two or three definite clicks in the right direction toward environmental consciousness. And, you know, the way to do that is to write the laws like Louisiana has written, like other states in this country have written, that hold these groups to a higher standard than they are now. And here's the good news. It pays all the way around. By simply requiring these refineries to add the infrastructure necessary to make the air cleaner, to make the water cleaner, you're going to create jobs by doing that. You're not taking away jobs. I mean, these things aren't installed by genies. You know, they're installed by hardworking steel workers or, you know, hardworking Texans. The other good side about that is that it enhances the tax base. So, you know, while we have the property tax system in Texas, you're going to see small towns like Deer Park, LaPorte, Baytown actually benefit from laws that incentivize the infrastructure that would make these plants cleaner, greener, whatever word you want to use. I mean, it's just up to us as legislators to send that unmistakable message rather than take money from lobby groups and turn a blind eye to what's really happening. It's not going to cost these refineries a significant percentage of their profit. In fact, they're very conscious organizations when it comes to social causes. You see them, you know, at the United Way always making great donations. It'll be the same kind of mindset. Let's just make the laws very clear. Let's let incentivize good practice, and I'm sure everyone will be better for it.
Okay. One of the contentious issues lately is over college tuitions. As you know, in 2003, the legislature deregulated the college tuition process for public universities. Basically, they let them set their own rates in return for taking less money up front from the state. Tuitions have risen greatly. People have complained that it's pricing public universities out from the middle class. What do you think about this?
The deregulation mantra has caused some damage in Texas over the last 15 years. You know, whether it's electricity or college tuition or insurance rates, government has sustained a lot of negativism from ideological leadership. You know, government's bad. We got to shrink it down and let the private sector, you know, rule the roost. Deregulation is a sort of partner to that ideology. And the reality is that you either should regulate it or totally unregulate it. And to do this kind of minimization of regulation is one of the worst things you can do, because the law is very unclear. There's loophole after loophole. We did very well for many, many years with the state making solid investment in higher education. And, you know, we weren't the only one. The whole United States has a university system over the balance of the 20th century that was the envy of the world. And that's why people came from all over the world to study in America. And University of Texas, Texas A&M, you know, other great universities in the area, University of Houston, are places that are like a melting pot. Now, the state has pulled back under the guise of giving us that, you know, ever sought after tax cut, and has just basically pulled the plug on serious investment. We may see in as few as 5 to 10 years the horror of institutional decay in education if we don't reverse this immediately. What I'll tell you, Charles, is, you know, we're a state that has the happy problem that more people want to come here every year. And, you know, we gain clout by that, but also it puts a severe strain. If we don't make sure that individuals are highly educated as they come to this state, it's going to be a greater burden every year on the social fabric of Texas. If people are educated, they're going to be able to take care of themselves. I mean, it's just like the biblical analogy of, you know, teach a man, you know, give a man a fish, he eats for a day, teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. Why can't that analogy be so clear that legislators realize, you know, one of the best things we can do is give people the equipment and they need to be talented, and that is education. So I want to reverse this deregulation bent in college tuition. Let's make it affordable so really anybody can go. It's not a question now of whether you can send Bobby or Susie or whoever your child is to Harvard. You may not be able to send him to the University of Texas, and that is wrong.
Yeah. When people go to vote starting on October 20th and going through November 4th this year, and they come to the Senate District 11 race, how do you want them to think about it?
I want them to think that the past 20 years of failed leadership in Austin has to be held accountable. You've heard about performance reviews at work. Well, the good news is that when there are elections, that's a performance review that every single Texas voter in Senate District 11 can take part in. What I'm asking the voters to do is ask themselves, are you proud of the way Texas is going right now, or do you have some concern that maybe a new leadership style is indicated? The last thing we need is more of the same, and Joe Jaworski represents a new, interested level of care that can be brought to the Texas government. And, you know, I represent, I think, a number of families and small businesses who want to see some new blood in Austin. So I want them to think about new versus the old failed leadership and vote for the new.
All right. Joe Jaworski, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Charles, thanks a lot, man.